It is nearly 12 o'clock, and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 43 degrees and fair. At the airport, they are showing steady westerly winds at 17 miles per hour, gusting to 32. And they have 10 miles of visibility. The Weather Service is advising us to look for sunny skies for the rest of the day and mostly clear skies tonight, too, becoming mostly cloudy toward daybreak or so. West winds 30 to 35 miles per hour today. And about the same wind speed tonight, coming down to 15 or 20 after midnight. For tomorrow, a slight chance of snow, followed by a chance of rain. Coming up on the Midday Report, the Kodiak Island Ambulatory Care Clinic was searched by officers from the Federal Bureau of Investigation last week. About 100 people gathered in Bethel on Friday for a federal hearing on the impact of the loss of salmon in that region. And Congresswoman Mary Peltola has voted in favor of defunding an Office of Gun Violence Prevention.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. In a first, the U.S. Supreme Court's adopting a code of ethics for its justices amid mounting criticism of gifts and trips from wealthy benefactors to certain justices, such as Justice Clarence Thomas. NPR's Nina Totenberg explains that the code attempts to be relatively specific about what justices can and cannot do, though there's no enforcement mechanism covering what justices are not supposed to do.
The code's very specific about financial transactions. You can have a real estate transaction as long as it's not before the court. And, of course, this code reaffirms the commitment to the disclosure provisions that are in the existing code for all judges and that have not been entirely followed in the past. And it's very specific about family members, spouses, children, grandchildren, and recusal if one of those has a case before the court or is a lawyer before the court.
NPR's Nina Totenberg's full report can be heard later on All Things Considered. Hundreds of patients and staff are trapped in Al-Shifa Hospital in northern Gaza. There's no fuel and little water. Israel continues its offensive against Hamas militants in the area. The Israeli military has told staff and patients to evacuate, but as NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports, for many in Al-Shifa and other hospitals, that option now seems impossible.
Paul Caney, the logistics coordinator for the charity Doctors Without Borders in Jerusalem, tells NPR the bombardment and fighting around Al-Shifa is so intense that his staff can't get to the hospital despite being in a building that's only about 200 meters away. Al-Shifa is now in its third day without fuel for power, and Caney says ambulances can't reach the trapped patients and staff.
Their lives are in peril, and that includes ICU babies.
The Palestinian Ministry of Health says incubators for 37 premature babies have stopped working because of the lack of fuel. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News.
In reaction to the threat facing the Gaza hospital, President Biden says
the hospital must be protected.
Though Biden supported humanitarian pauses, he has stopped short of calling for a ceasefire. An experimental treatment is showing the first hints that gene editing might offer a safe and effective way to fight the nation's leading killer, heart disease. Here's NPR's Rob Stein.
Researchers at a Boston biotech company say they have produced the first evidence that gene editing can safely and effectively cut high cholesterol. Verve Therapeutics says the results of the first 10 patients who volunteered for a study testing gene editing indicates the approach is safe and can effectively lower cholesterol. The study is being conducted on people with a genetic predisposition to very high cholesterol, but the hope is that gene editing could provide an alternative way to reduce cholesterol in anyone. Much more research is needed, however. Rob Stein, NPR News.
It's NPR.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor, llama al 907-481-2400.
Support for KMXT comes from Alaska's most advanced network. GCI's resilient and redundant network is keeping schools connected across the state. Details at gci.com/education.
For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. The Kodiak Island Ambulatory Care Clinic, a medical office downtown, was searched by officers from the Federal Bureau of Investigation last week. KMXT's Brian Venois reports, despite the raid, the clinic is still open and no charges have been filed.
The medical clinic was raided by federal, state, and local law enforcement searching for illegal substances on Tuesday morning. John Kohler is the medical director and owner of the clinic. He says the incident was a complete shock.
And then they just pulled up, just like in the movies, and they come out and, you know, tell me to step back, put my hands up, and they search me, and then...
He says they also took his cell phones while they looked around. A representative for the FBI field office in Anchorage said in an email on Wednesday that they were, quote, assisting the Alaska Medicaid Fraud Control Unit in their lawful execution of state search warrants, end quote. The Kodiak Police Department also sent uniformed officers to stand by outside during the raid, but a representative for the department said in a phone call that they did not participate in the search. Kohler says he and his staff did their best to cooperate with law enforcement.
My understanding was a big part of it was they were looking for drugs, somebody had reported. And they searched here in my home and did not find any drugs.
The searches took about 6 hours each, but neither he nor the clinic has been charged since the incident. Kohler says he's lived and practiced in Kodiak for over 2 decades, performing routine care like checkups, urgent care, and some minor surgeries. He says they had to reschedule all of the patients scheduled for that day.
It's a very humiliating experience, and I thought it was very unnecessary. I'm very cooperative, they didn't handcuff me. That was nice.
The clinic is still open and serving patients as of Thursday. Further investigation is being handled by the Alaska Department of Law. Its communications director could only confirm that the investigation is ongoing and did not provide further details. In Kodiak, I'm Brian Benoit.
About 100 people gathered in Bethel on Friday for a federal field hearing on the impact of the loss of salmon in the region. As KYUK's Evan Erickson reports, Senator Lisa Murkowski, vice chair of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs, heard from dozens on the impacts of an historic decline.
Usually, the gathering place at the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation Hospital in Bethel is full of people who have come in for medical appointments. On Friday, they came to talk about salmon. Murkowski's field hearing started with the testimony of 8 invited witnesses. They represented a large slice of the Alaska Native groups calling for tribal co-management of resources. They laid out why salmon are so important to the region's tribes and why their loss is so devastating. Here's Tanana Chiefs Conference Chair Brian Ridley.
Recently, we documented our customary and traditional use of salmon back 11,000 years, proving how far back our people were salmon people. I had an elder talk to us from our region who said, they lived through the Great Depression, but they didn't even know there was a Great Depression because we had all that we needed.
Witnesses also echoed the need to strengthen Title VIII of the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, or ANILCA. That law spells out a priority for the subsistence harvest of fish and wildlife, but management has been controversial, and right now the state and federal government are tangled in a lawsuit over management on the Kuskokwim River. Association of Village Council President's Chair Thaddeus Tikyun summed up the political situation regarding the salmon crisis.
While over 100 tribal communities are being restricted to the point of being unable to catch a single salmon, the state of Alaska and some federal management agencies are carrying on business as usual.
Kuskokwim Intertribal Fish Commission Chair Jonathan Samuelson says the loss of salmon carries a psychological toll for people who live here.
One of the hardest illnesses comes from not being able to share. We're meant to be able to share with our aunties, to share with our invited guests. Our protocols are being broken, our values are being challenged, and our way of life is at risk, and it only elevates our unwellness.
During the listening session, Murkowski sat alone at a small table as more than 30 people stepped up to a podium to address her, some with the help of an interpreter. Many were from Bethel and nearby villages, but others came from Yukon River communities hit hardest by the loss of salmon. Nick Andrew came from the lower Yukon village of Marshall, where he is the tribal president.
We bear the brunt of the conservation. We, the end users, the little people, the people that matter, have been silenced. We've been marginalized by the very government that's here to protect our interests as citizens of the United States of America.
Consultant Jim Simon says he has noticed a disconnect between government management and traditional knowledge.
You know, it seems that state and federal agencies are always 10 to 20 years behind indigenous knowledge. I remember more than 20 years ago, people along the Yukon talking about the declining size of fish, the change in their shape and morphology, suggesting that something was happening in the ocean decades ago.
On the theme of co-management, there were strong calls throughout the hearing for Alaska Native representation on the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. The council manages the pollock trawl fishery, responsible for the vast majority of Western Alaska's salmon bycatch. Fritz Charles of Bethel spoke about bycatch.
No more another 15, 20 years of, oh, let's do a study. No more studies. We need to put a cap on trawlers in Area M. That's what we need today. No more.
Murkowski's Senate committee will take comments for another 2 weeks. Send them to testimony@indian.senate.gov. That's testimony@indian.senate.gov. In Bethel, I'm Evan Erickson.
Alaska Congresswoman Mary Peltola voted Wednesday night in favor of defunding a new White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention. She was one of only two Democrats to vote for the defunding amendment, which did not pass. Peltola's office declined to comment on her vote. The sponsor of the measure, Republican Matt Rosendale of Montana, argued that President Biden has attacked the Second Amendment rights of gun owners.
And now, with the stroke of a pen, President Biden created the Office of Gun Violence Prevention, allowing his administration to bypass Congress unilaterally and implement the left's gun control agenda.
Democratic Congressman Matt Cartwright of Pennsylvania defended the new office created in September. He says it will promote solutions that respect the rights of lawful gun owners.
The White House Gun Violence Task Force is committed to treating gun violence as the public health crisis it is.
Peltola has positioned herself as a moderate. Opposing gun control measures is one of the most visible ways she breaks with Democrats and follows in the footsteps of her Republican predecessor, the late Congressman Don Young. Eight Republicans voted against the defunding measure, sinking the amendment. One person died in a fire at an outdoor camp in East Anchorage on Thursday morning. According to the Anchorage Fire Department, a passerby reported the fire in a wooded area of Bancroft Park at 7:20 a.m. Thursday. Anchorage police and firefighters arrived and found the fire, a victim, and one other person displaced by the fire. Crews got the fire under control within minutes. Anchorage Fire Department Assistant Chief Alex Boyd says the person who died was asleep when a small heat source inside the tent started the fire, which appears to have caused their death.
First notification wasn't, or the medical examiner's office will be the one that finally declares the cause of death.
The Anchorage Police Department is investigating the death. The victim's name won't be released until the next of kin are notified. According to the fire department, a dozen people have now died in fires in Anchorage this year. Two others were also in outdoor encampments. In an interview at the end of July, Boyd said firefighters were responding more frequently to fires affecting the city's unhoused community. Now, as winter begins, he says the department is hearing about fewer fires, but not necessarily because there are fewer fires.
Okay. So we aren't getting as many calls because I think they're just not being seen as frequently. Like this one was fairly well hidden off in the brush area and not visible from the road until it actually caught fire. That was a passerby called the fire again.
Boyd says the fire department and Red Cross held fire safety education outreach events over the summer at denser homeless sites and installed smoke detectors in campers, motorhomes, and regular cars people were using as shelters. As part of Native American Heritage Month, The American Bar Association recently asked a group of Native women to talk about how they became both lawyers and trailblazers. The panel included the U.S. Interior Secretary, Alaska's former Lieutenant Governor Valerie Davidson, and other Native women who have made their mark in the legal world. As KNBA's Rhonda McBride reports, there were some common threads in their discussion.
For Native American women in law, Secretary Deb Holland says there is a lot to celebrate, but also some heavy lifting to do.
We cannot honor these accomplishments in a vacuum.
Holland says it's good that there are more Native women in law, but this progress comes amid what she calls somber reminders, from the marginalization of Native Americans to the chronic neglect of missing, murdered, and indigenous people.
The MMIP crisis will take the brilliance of legal minds like yours to overcome the jurisdictional challenges that make it difficult to address.
The women on the panel said a strong desire to serve their communities motivated them to go to law school, as well as encouragement from their elders, especially aunties and grandmas. Valerie Davidson, a Yupik from Southwest Alaska, began to take an interest in law when she worked as a legislative aide to put herself through college. It was then she realized that lobbyists armed with law degrees had the most success in changing government policy.
One of the things I did very intentionally was refuse every offer to become a prosecutor. And my response was really direct. No thanks. You're doing a great job of putting our people in jail. You don't need our help to do that more effectively. You're doing just fine on your own.
Davidson, now president and CEO of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, says a law degree gave her a seat at the table as a decision maker, as well as the opportunity to be a game changer.
Not only being at the table, but designing a different table that is more inclusive is setting up an expectation of behavior and really upping everybody's game.
Stacy Leeds, a Native law and policy scholar, also weighed in. Leeds, who is a dean of law at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at the University of Arizona, says Native lawyers can serve as mentors to the Western legal system, which she says has a lot to learn from tribes and their values.
They seem to be spoken about as if their finest days were somewhere in the past. And that's the complete opposite. Most of our tribes right now are undergoing a pretty profound renaissance in language, in arts, in culture.
The panel also talked about the need to include tribes at state and federal levels of government. Valerie Davidson says when she was Alaska's health commissioner, it was sometimes as simple as picking up a pen.
Actually, a Sharpie would do. Add a comma and add the word tribes and tribal organizations. You will do more to advance our efforts than you would imagine.
The lawyers say they need to work harder to educate others about the benefits of tribal courts and tribal government. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
For decades, the city of Homer has diverted storm water into Kachemak Bay without treatment. Now the city is working on creating green infrastructure to improve the storm water entering the bay. KVVI's Jamie Deep reports on how the city is using wetlands to treat the storm water.
Early last year, City Engineer and Public Works Director Jan Kaiser proposed four systems to improve the drainage system for the city's storm water. The systems utilize green infrastructure and are some of the first in the state. Kaiser said this type of infrastructure relies on wetlands and peatlands to treat stormwater, improving its quality.
Green infrastructure relies on existing natural systems. So we're using the natural environment to help with the built environment that created the contamination.
So far, three of the four proposed projects are underway. One project includes treating water near Bishop's Beach in the vault system before channeling it into the Lucas Slough wetlands for further treatment and restoring the natural area. At two meetings last month, Homer City Council approved four contracts to appraise the project, as well as to construct specific parts for the vault that would filter out sediments and pollutants from the water. Altogether, the contracts are using nearly $180,000 in the city's budget. The Homer Accelerated Roads and Trails Fund and the Department of Environmental Conservation grants provide the main funding. However, this one system isn't enough. Kaiser said that another vault is needed nearby to handle the amount of stormwater in the area.
We need something else, and we found that something else at Hanson Avenue. But we don't have funding for Hanson Avenue, so we'll need to go back to council and get additional funding for Hanson.
Now, Kaiser is working with contractors to study the wetlands and design the infrastructure to direct the water. In addition to this system, the city is acquiring 50 acres of wetlands through the Kachemak Green Sponge Project. The wetlands would act as a nature-based way to treat stormwater in the area while addressing drainage issues on two major streets, East End Road and Kachemak Drive.
We are in the process of surveying, doing appraisals of the property, replatting some of the property where that's necessary, and doing design work for the stormwater works themselves.
The city granted $30,000 to the Kachemak Heritage Land Trust to help them acquire the land and is waiting for approval on a grant from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration for this project. Kaiser expects the actual land acquisition should take place over the course of 2 to 3 years. Other projects awaiting funding include purchasing wetlands near Ben Walters Park and diverting stormwater on Baycrest Hill near the Sterling Highway. Kaiser said that these projects can address issues with erosion the city has been facing for years.
Part of the problem with stormwater is it will find its own place to go. So by creating these green infrastructure systems, we provide positive pathways for the water to go where we want it to go, where we're able to manage where the erosion is occurring and mitigate against that. That's the plan anyway.
These projects have been in motion and have had support since early 2022. The Public Works Department plans to continue survey and construction work as well as request additional funding in the next fiscal year. In Homer, I'm Jamie Deep.
The wind is blowing here in Kodiak, but at least it's not snowing. A second winter storm since Thursday's massive snow dump has again paralyzed Anchorage and much of South Central Alaska just a week after the city's first major snowfall this season. Anchorage School District and Mat-Su Borough Schools both declared remote learning days today, with the University of Alaska Anchorage also closed. State offices in Anchorage and Mat-Su, as well as Municipality of Anchorage offices, are all closed as well. Anchorage's People Mover bus service has been suspended for today, and Anchorage Rides is making only essential trips. According to the National Weather Service, Anchorage is under a winter storm warning until noon today, with 6 to 9 inches of snow expected in most areas. The heaviest snowfall is forecasted for the Anchorage and Eagle River hillsides, which could receive up to a foot of snow today. Western parts of Prince William Sound and the eastern Kenai Peninsula are under a blizzard warning until 4 p.m. today, with 4 to 6 inches of snow and winds gusting to 50 miles per hour.
The country's credit rating could soon take another hit. I'm Nova Safo with a Marketplace Minute. Moody's is the last of the top three ratings agencies on Wall Street to maintain a top rating on U.S. government debt. That could soon change. Moody's has lowered its outlook on federal debt to negative, meaning a downgrade is possible. The agency cited rising interest rates and congressional gridlock. Standard & Poor's and Fitch have already downgraded the country's debt, which makes borrowing more expensive. President Joe Biden and China's leader Xi Jinping are scheduled to meet this week on the sidelines of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit taking place in San Francisco. Trade relations have worsened between the two biggest economies ever since the Trump administration imposed new tariffs on Chinese goods. I'm Nova Safo with a Marketplace Minute.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Monday. It is the 13th day of November, the year 2023. The sun rose today at 8:50. It will set again at 4:56, giving us 8 hours and 6 minutes of precious daylight, a loss of 4 minutes and 14 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record high temperature for this date was 49 degrees. That was set in 1982 and then again in 2018. Our record low was 12 degrees, set in 1977. Currently 44 degrees and fair and windy. Out at the airport, they are showing steady westerly winds at 26 miles per hour, gusting to 43. They do have 10 miles of visibility. and 43% humidity. The Weather Service expects sunny skies today with a high near 45 and west winds 30 to 35. And mostly clear skies tonight, becoming mostly cloudy towards daybreak or so. 20% chance of snow after 3 a.m. Look for a low of 33 overnight tonight with west winds 25 to 30, coming down to 15 or 20 after midnight. For tomorrow, a slight chance of snow before 3 p.m., then a chance of rain. Mostly cloudy tomorrow with a high near 44, west winds to 15, becoming light and variable tomorrow morning. Look for rain to begin tomorrow night, though, with southeast winds to 15, gusting to 25. Looking at our local tides, we have a high tide coming up this afternoon. That will happen at 1:14 on the east side and be 10 feet, followed by a low tide at 7:59, call it 8 p.m., of minus 9/10. Over on the west side, your high tide will happen at 1:50 this afternoon, 10 minutes to 2, and be 15.7 feet in Larsen Bay, followed by a low tide at 8:30 p.m. of minus 1.9 feet there. Mariners, here is your weather forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanak out to 15 nautical miles. Small craft advisory through tonight with west winds at 30 knots, becoming west 25 tonight. 8-foot seas coming down to 6 feet tonight, and southwest 15 becoming southeast tomorrow afternoon with seas to 3 feet. They are calling for southeast 25 Tuesday night with 7-foot seas, and southwest 35 on Wednesday with seas coming up to 15 feet on our east side on Wednesday. Over in the Shelikof Strait, small craft advisory through tonight with west winds to 30 knots and seas to 8 feet today, becoming west 25 and seas to 6 feet tonight. For tomorrow, southwest 15 in the morning, becoming variable 10 with seas to 3 feet. And for Wednesday, look for southwest 30 and seas to 11 feet on the west side. Join Diet and the Love Soldiers and the Kodiak Arts Council tomorrow at 4 p.m. for their community outreach, Music from an Indigenous Perspective, workshop and performance. Diet will be guiding the community through a musical encounter of Indigenous identity and understanding. Using a combination of traditional stories and songs and movement, Diet seeks to build an appreciation of Indigenous music. This event is free for everybody and is taking place at the Gerald C. Wilson's Auditorium Band Room. For more information, go to the Kodiak Arts Council's website at www.kodiakarts.org or just show up at 4 p.m. tomorrow at the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium Band Room. Also tomorrow, the KMXT Board of Directors will be holding their next regular monthly meeting. That's happening at 6 p.m. tomorrow in the KMXT building here at 620 Egan Way. The meeting is open to the public, and members of the public are always encouraged to attend. For more information, call 486-3181. You can also Zoom the meeting, email gm@kmxt.org, and they'll send you the Zoom link. Also tomorrow, Scuttlebutt goes on. It's the Galley Tables Workshop for Youth, 4 p.m. to 5:30 p.m. at the Kodiak Public Library's Craft Room. It's a free weekly storytelling workshop for students grades 9 through 12. They practice building and sharing stories with the help of experienced storytellers. For more information, call 907-486-7396. But again, that's tomorrow starting at 4 p.m. at the library. Navigating the Holidays After Loss Open House Workshop is happening on Thursday. That's going on from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Kodiak Public Library. The holidays can be a challenging time for the bereaved. Join Hospice and Palliative Care of Kodiak for an open house event for individuals and families grieving a loved one this holiday season. It's a family-friendly remembrance activities and crafts and refreshments from 4 to 5:30 p.m. on Thursday. From 6 to 7 p.m., they offer tools, resources, and meaningful discussions with a bereavement facilitator, Julie Belden. Support from others walking your similar journey. Call 907-512-0600 for more information. But again, that's on Thursday, 4 to 7 p.m. at the Kodiak Public Library.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.